Okay, so here we are in 2 Samuel chapter 19. The King David, there had been a civil war, and King David's son, Absalom, had declared himself king after winning over the hearts of the people with his extreme good looks, his gorgeous hair, his charismatic personality. And he had come in, occupied Jerusalem before he got there with his army. It says virtually all of the fighting men in Jerusalem had joined him. David had fled. He did not want to see this blessed city. He didn't want to see the blessed city destroyed. He didn't want to see the temple destroyed. He didn't. He loved the city that much. So he left. There was an ensuing civil war, and David's troops under Joab were victorious, and Absalom, David's son, was killed. He was killed by Joab. And so then what happens is that David starts coming back to Jerusalem to become king, and that's where we are. He's starting to come back to Jerusalem to become king. He's asked his own tribe, the tribe of Judah, to invite him back, and he does so, you could say, through some political strategy. He allows the general of Absalom's army, to take over as general of his, David's army. And so Judah sort of figures out, well, if he's going to have the general of the army that came against him as his own general, that means he's probably going to be lenient on us. See, they had betrayed David, and they were no doubt thinking, well, David, when if he comes back and is king again, he's going to kill us all. But when David makes Amasa, who had just recently been a general of Absalom army, when he makes him general of his own army, that puts their fears to rest. And so they invite him back. He is on his way back to Jerusalem. Now, on his way back to Jerusalem, there are certain people who meet him on the way back to Jerusalem. If you remember, on his way out of Jerusalem, a stream of people had met up with him on his way out of Jerusalem. And it was a very emotional scene with people who had come up to him and were basically swearing allegiance to him. And he was very gracious to the people. He even gave them the opportunity to go back and to Jerusalem, and even tried to persuade some of them not to come out with him. It was a wonderful scene in 2 Samuel 15 of just the people that had loved David so much, even though it appeared that David was going to be leaving the Israel and never to return as the king. They went with him. But if you remember in chapter 16, there was someone else who met him on the way out of the city. It was a man named by the name of Shimei. Now, Shimei was a Benjamite. Saul was a Benjamite. And David had reigned for 30 years. And there were some in that tribe of Saul's. Saul, remember, was killed by the Philistines right prior. And that's what initiated David coming in as king. But there had been some Benjamites for years and years and years coveting that place that they once had under Saul and sort of in their hearts, rebellious, maybe on the outside, acting like they were loyal to David. But one of these guys was his name was Shimei. And on David's way out of the city, again, Absalom's taken over really all of Israel. He had come in and he had been crowned king in Israel. And David's on his way out. He's essentially fleeing. And this man, Shimei, comes up to David and his procession and starts to curse him. He says in 2 Samuel 16, verse 7, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. And then it says in verse 8 of chapter 16, so now you are caught in your own evil. So he's telling David he's evil because you're a bloodthirsty man. Now, this is the guy who, according to the Bible, is the man after God's own heart. He is also the man after he dies. He's the king whose life was the standard of righteousness for every other king that reigned. But he's being called here by this man bloodthirsty. He's being called evil. And he's also throwing rocks at him. So he's cursing him. And one of his generals, Abishai, says, David, I just need to take this guy's head off. And David said to Abishai, let him alone, because the Lord has ordered him to curse me. Now, that's a shocking statement for a king. And David went on and said to Abishai, it may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for the fact that this man is cursing me this day. So in a time of his great humiliation, when he's greatly, greatly humbled, at a time where you would think his temper would be really short, that he would be snapping at people, where his flesh would just be, you know, breaking out like fire against people or going into a rage. He is just a picture of Christ-like meekness here. I mean, it's almost a picture of like Jesus going to the cross where, he was being cursed and the religious leaders were mocking him, saying things like, here's the guy who saved many people. If he's really the Son of God, let him save himself. And they were insulting him. And ironically, very, very close, in a place very, very close to where David is at this very, very moment, fleeing Jerusalem. And David remains very, very meek at this time. And that's just remarkable. And when we were reading about what Shimei was talking about, we took a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. We recently had Bible verse memorization night in our church, and man, no one memorized these verses, but they'd be verses that are very good for all of us to memorize. Where David had a thorn in his, rather the Apostle Paul had a thorn in his side. Three times he asked God to take out the thorn, but God said, no, I'm not going to do it. And famously says in verse 9 of chapter 12 of 2 Corinthians, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul says, therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of God may rest, but rather the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And so that's an astonishing statement, to say the very least. Paul says, I delight in reproaches. What's a reproach? The very thing that Shimei was doing to David, calling him a bloodthirsty man, calling him evil, calling him a rogue. Paul says, I delight in it. Now, why? Because when I am weak, then I am strong. There's just a recognition when we're in a low, low place that we are giving God great opportunity to exercise his strength in a big, big way in our lives. And so why do I talk about this as we introduce 2 Samuel chapter 18 tonight? Well, because we are reintroduced here to this guy, Shimei. When David is coming back to Jerusalem, my place here. I lost my place. I apologize here. Just looking for my place. Verse 16 of 2 Samuel chapter 19. So David is on his way back to Jerusalem to become king again. His troops had been victorious over Absalom's troops. And who meets him on the way back as he crosses over the River Jordan to go back into the land of Israel? Well, it's this guy, Shimei. It says in verse 16, and Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. And Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants was with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. Then he said to the king, do not let my lord impute iniquity to me. So this guy is sure that David, when he comes back, is going to be hunting him down and killing him. Because when he had met David on his way out, David was at an extremely vulnerable place. He was retreating with, relatively speaking, a handful of men compared to what Absalom's army was, and was insulting him gravely. Well, what is David going to do now when he's back in power? Well, you got to give the guy a little credit. He just, rather than being hunted down, he went right up to David and he begged for mercy. And it says, he said to the king, "Do not let my Lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my Lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come down today of all the house of Joseph to go down and to meet my Lord the king." So whether or not this guy is, Shimei is truly repentant, I don't know. We are going to see him later on in 2 Samuel, and there are some indications that maybe he wasn't really repentant here. But in verse 21, Abishai again, remember, he's the one who wanted to take Shimei's head off when they were leaving Jerusalem. So David's coming back to Jerusalem now, and Shimei shows up again, and Abishai hasn't learned from his previous behavior, but Abishai, the son of Zariah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" And David said, "What have I to do with you, the sons of Zariah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" Therefore the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king swore to him. And so Jesus is called the Son of David. That is one of his titles. When he was approaching the blind man, they would cry out, "O Son of David." Jesus, of course, was a perfect fulfillment. David was just a foreshadowing, just shadows of the perfection of Jesus to come. But Jesus had said what in the Sermon on the Mount and also in Luke chapter 6? He says, "I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you." And so what I think is noteworthy here, it says when Abishai wants to kill this guy, Shimei, and David says to him, "I don't want to have anything to do with you." He says, "Today, you're an adversary to me. You're opposing me. You're an enemy of me." It reminds me a little of when Jesus was going to Jerusalem. He told the apostles that he'd be crucified, and David says, "We'll never let that happen to you." And Jesus said, "What? Get behind me, Satan!" There's a picture of righteousness here that the Lord is trying to give to the nation of Israel, and everyone afterward reading the story, a picture of mercy, a picture of what Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies, but a foreshadowing, a picture of the Messiah. And here Abishai is coming, trying to thwart God's purposes of wanting to give everyone a picture of the coming Messiah by wanting to actually kill the man, Shimei. And so he's actually called an adversary here, an enemy. "Why are you an enemy to me today?" That seems kind of harsh when Abishai is just trying to do him a favor of putting someone to death who appeared to be a rebel. and someone who had aligned himself with someone who had usurped the throne illegally, and had because of the rebellion, what was it, 20,000 Israelite soldiers at least had died. And yet, what does David say? You're an enemy to me today. God takes so seriously in the Bible the types in the Old Testament. Remember Moses, second time around, where he water came from the rock. He hit the rock twice. God told him just to speak it. Then he could speak to the rock, and he hit it instead. And he got angry in front of Israel. We find out in Corinthians in the New Testament that that rock was Christ. And so why was Moses' punishment was not going into the promised land? Why was the punishment so extreme? Because he had messed with a type, and that was about what Abishai was about to do here. So this incredible picture of Messiah to come, of number one, letting him, just as Jesus was going to the cross and being insulted by people. But then even when he was on the cross and thereafter, Jesus said, forgive these people who are insulting, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And so incredible picture, foreshadowing of Jesus Christ himself here. And extraordinary interchange there between David and his general Abishai. Verse 24 says, now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. And so it was when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go to the king because your servant is lame. But he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king? So the king said to him, why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. So here again, a fair amount of background is needed. I'll try to do it in rather short order. Remember that David, after Saul and Jonathan had been killed by the Philistines, wanted to honor his covenant with Jonathan and take care of Jonathan's descendants. Well, Jonathan had one descendant. He had one son by the name of Mephibosheth, but Mephibosheth, when he was just a tiny young boy in the arms of his nanny, his nurse, the nurse fell and the baby fell. He became lame and he was unable to walk. David, again, wanting to honor his covenant with Jonathan, who had been a covenant brother of his, just very close friend, brought Mephibosheth into his palace and covenanted with him, promised to have let him be with him permanently, eating at the king's table for his whole life. Well, when Absalom had taken over and David was on his way out of the city, who shows up but Ziba? And Ziba was had also been a had been in charge of a lot of Jonathan's again Saul's son Jonathan's goods, his flocks and stuff like that. Well, David had previously asked Ziba to be the servant, sort of the chief foreman for Mephibosheth, and that all Jonathan's goods and his flocks and his anything that he his property would be under the supervision of Ziba, who would in turn report and be the servant of Mephibosheth. Well, when David's on his way out fleeing Jerusalem, Ziba shows up, and he feigns, I would say, he fakes loyalty to David, and David says, well, what are you doing here? Where is Mephibosheth? And Ziba tells him, oh, he has stayed in Jerusalem, and he has the intention when Absalom's army defeats yours to make himself king. Now, this was a lie. Yeah, Ziba was a scoundrel by saying that. How do we really know that? Well, virtually all commentators are in agreement here that the evidence is right in verse 24, where Mephibosheth, he hasn't cared for his feet, he hasn't trimmed his mustache, he hasn't washed his clothes, so he would have been a public spectacle in Jerusalem because he's in the state of mourning. As he says in verse 24, he was in this state and he was going to stay like it until David returned in peace. So he would have been, well, he would have been identified as a traitor to Absalom. Absalom, of course, knew Mephibosheth was at the king's table. He risked his life to be mourning in such a way while Absalom was in power. And so, and not only that, let's face it, the Ziba's original lie that, or his original statement to David that, oh, Mephibosheth is just staying by, so he would could become king someday. It is on its face absurd, and that's a great understatement. I mean, why would Mephibosheth ever think, with Absalom coming in with a gigantic army, that somehow Mephibosheth is going to be made king? No, Ziba really wanted to just take over all of Mephibosheth's possessions, his flocks, his herds, his possessions. And so at that time, when David was fleeing, he said, okay, Ziba, it's all yours. Well, now David's in a quandary because he's coming back into Jerusalem and he's being told this story. And he basically just says, listen, you just divide it with Mephibosheth, divide the all the property with Ziba. Give him half, give him you half. And the way I personally read this is that David is exhausted. He's lost a lot of the strength of his youth. He has a ton of issues on his mind, incredibly more important than this dispute over property. And, you know, because a lot of people read this, why did David leave anything for Ziba? Why did he ever do that? I believe this is, again, we'll get this, I think, a little bit later in this, in the lesson tonight. Ministry's messy. Life is messy. Leaders are flawed. Until we get to the messianic kingdom where Jesus is our leader and underneath him, there's going to be a government of men and with glorified bodies, with glorified minds. There's going to be a lot of flaws. And here, I think in time of weakness, he just didn't want to deal with it. And so Mephibosheth says there, after David says, listen, just take half, he says, verse 30, just look, just let Ziba take it all. I'm just happy you're back in peace. So very much, you know, very much the case here was that Ziba really was a scoundrel, and Mephibosheth really was a man of God, who we've always known him to be. But David here, in a time of weakness, doesn't really do the best thing. Verse 31 continues, and Barzillai the Gileadite came down from Rogelim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now, Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. Now, remember in chapter 17, David is fleeing. He's fleeing with, relatively speaking, he has a handful of people compared to Absalom's army, but that's still hundreds of his mighty men, probably 600 mighty men and their families. And hey, that's a lot of food and supplies that are needed. Well, Barzillai comes in at great risk to himself, because if Absalom winds up winning, Barzillai's head and his family's lives would be destroyed as a result of it. But he knew a righteous man when he saw him, and he knew a scoundrel in Absalom when he saw him, and he provided the king with supplies. And so here he shows up again when David's coming back into Jerusalem, and David said to him in verse 33, come across with me, I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between good and bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Meaning, you know, he's so old, he's lost his taste buds. Man, I hope my taste buds don't go that early if I happen to live to 80 years old. Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? So no ear aids at that time. Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? In other words, he's saying to David, look, if I go in there, I'm an older guy, I'm just going to be a burden to you. Let me just stay here. Verse 36, your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant Chimeon. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. And so Chimeon, I believe he is a relative of Barzillai. I believe he is. Barzillai still would like to have a member of his own family, a member of his own contingent, be a part of what is going on in Jerusalem. And so verse 38 says, and the king answered, Chimeon shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now, whatever you request of me, I will do for you. So he leaves Barzillai behind. It says, then all the people went over the Jordan. When the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai, blessed him, and he returned to his own place. Verse 40, now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimeon went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. So what's going on here is that in verse 40, remember, there's really all 12 tribes of Israel had abandoned David and had gone over to Absalom. So in everyone's mind, there is, what's this guy David going to do when he comes back and is king? Are we going to be in a lot of trouble? Now, as we talked about earlier, Judah had more or less, their fears had been relieved or put to rest by David. So that's why verse 40 says, all Judah escorted the king. But it's interesting here. It also says half the people of Israel were there too. I mean, some of them had figured out, kind of like Shimei, hey, we better get down there and show our faces. Otherwise, we may be in a lot of trouble. So in verse 41, it says, just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across Jordan? So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over the matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? Now that's a real important half a verse there. Notice there that David had been a fair, just king. He had not favored the tribe of Judah during the 30 years that he had been the king of all Israel. That's why they say there at the end of verse 32, have we ever eaten at the king's expense? The king has never given us anything. We've never had any advantage as a result of being from the same tribe of the king. He's treated you no differently than he's treated us. Verse 43, and the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, therefore we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? So again, remember, after David defeated Absalom, there's this big question, what's David going to do now? Well, David waits until he was invited back. And it's we know that the men of Judah had invited him back, but here we see also that the other 10 tribes had invited him back as well. And then they bring up the argument that, oh, by the way, we're 10 and you guys are just 2, meaning Judah and Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin was all often grouped. It's a very small tribe, the smallest tribe. It was often grouped with Judah. And Levi, by the way, was also a small tribe, but of the non-Levitical tribes, Benjamin was the smallest. So it was often, because of its proximity to the tribe of Judah, it was also often just globbed on to them. And so this petty bickering is resulting because people are essentially jockeying for position. Once David's in power, they want to make sure that their tribes are treated well by the king. So really what it amounted to was petty bickering, because David had already proved to them for 30 years, about 30 years. Remember, Judah was, he was king over Judah for 6 or 7 years before the other 10 or 11 tribes joined him. But he had treated all the tribes fairly throughout his reign. He had had representatives from them in his government. He hadn't given any favoritism to them. But there's this, remember, these people are, they've been in the flesh. They've just gone over to Absalom because he was a handsome, charismatic guy. Very foolish behavior. They're still in the flesh here. They're involved in this petty bickering. And it says at the end of verse 43, it says that the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel, which appears to mean that somehow in bringing David back to Judah, the men of Judah are given sort of muscle out the people that have come from the other tribes to escort him back to the palace and throne. So they had been sort of muscled out. So then in chapter 20, we see there's going to be this guy, Sheba, who is going to take advantage of it. Now, I had just said that usually the Benjamites were globbed on to Judah, but here they become a part, the Benjamites become a part of a rebellion of the 11 tribes all against Judah. It says in chapter 20, and there happened to be there a rebel, a son of Belial, and in the literal Hebrew, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. Now this guy's his name sort of lives in infamy. He's kind of like Abimelech, the son of Gideon through a mistress who also led a rebellion, as well as other rebels, the sons of Korah against Moses. There's really a hall of shame in the Bible of people who rebelled against the God's appointed kings and leaders, and this guy Sheba is one of them. His name is Sheba, so he's present there while there's this petty bickering in verse 43. There's all this bickering going on, and at the end of verse 43, it says the men of Judah, apparently it says their words were fiercer, meaning they muscled up and they single-handedly escorted, at some point it appears they single-handedly escorted David back to Jerusalem, or at least they pushed the other 11 tribes to the side. And so this man, Sheba, took advantage of the situation, and then verse 1 continues, he blows a trumpet and says that we have no share in David, meaning we're not related to David in that we're not in his tribe. They were related. They were all Jews, but we're not in his tribe. We have no share in David, nor do we have any inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So every man of Israel deserted David. I just want to pause there. And remember, yet again, the shocking tendency that we have as human beings to live and just be motivated by the praise and approval of men. There is a part of us, there certainly is in me, that is, it, you know, the Bible says that the heart of man is desperately wicked beyond cure. Who can know it? And Paul says in Romans chapter 7, in the flesh there is no good thing. Well, part of that no good flesh that we have is just a tendency to really covet, to desire, to long for the praise of men. And we do all kinds of stupid stuff. And when we're saved, God gives us a new spirit. And in Galatians 2:20, it says, the old is gone, the new has come. Anyone who is Christ is a new creation, the Bible says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, I believe that's anyone who is in Christ has crucified the flesh. In 2 Corinthians 5, there's that wonderful verse that says, anyone who is in Christ is a new creation, the old is gone, the new has come. Where the Holy Spirit has now invaded our life. We're now the temple of the Holy Spirit, and we begin to overcome this terrible tendency in us to want the approval and praise of man. But you know, it's a lifelong battle. But 2 Corinthians 3:18, we go from glory to glory to glory as God just grows us up into the likeness of Christ. But I tell you, it takes a lifetime. But again, this one part of our flesh, which is really diabolical in nature, because it's really how the devil, Lucifer, he rebelled, and his sin, the reason he was cast out of heaven was the same thing, just wanting the admiration, approval of men. But we see in this verse how silly it is, how absurd it is for any of us to ever be striving for the approval and the praise and the admiration of men. Why is it so absurd? Because in a minute, it is gone. And there, in just a minute, we've already seen this once, where after ruling very in an outstanding way for 30 years, in such a way that really there was fulfillment of the promise that had been made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. David had come in and taken a nation that was under so much trouble in Saul that just continuously being raided by their enemies. David establishes peace, incredible prosperity in the land under David. But in an instant, some young, handsome dude comes in with charisma. They're all gone. And it just shows us, oh God, would you show us the absurdity of coveting after the admiration of men? And as Paul says, I believe in the book of Galatians, that we should be all about seeking after having God pleased at us, God, the praise of God, rather than the praise of men. So these guys had just moments earlier had gone back to David and had agreed to make him king over them, had realized that, wow, what did we ever do to get behind this guy, Absalom? Yeah, let's get David back. But here they are abandoning him, just like that. So that's how foolish it is to go after the admiration of men. So every man in Israel departed David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to their king. So at this point, it really is 11 tribes against one. Benjamites, this guy Sheba, also like Shimei, may have had that same covetous bitterness that, you know, 30 years ago, Saul, who was a Benjamite, he was one of us, ruled over the land. Might it be that we have that glory again? And it was just a lie from Belial, from the devil. And so he takes advantage of the situation and he foments a rebellion. Verse 3 says, now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and it says, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, who had left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. Remember that upon Ahithophel's advice, Absalom had gone into the concubines after his father had left in order to just show all Israel that this is a clear break from David's reign. Absalom is now king. Well, David supports them, but does not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. He supported them, but they no longer had access to him. Verse 4, and the king said to Amasa, remember, he's now, Amasa's the king of the army. By the way, why? Because David had caught on to the fact that Joab had killed his son Absalom, who, although he had fomented a civil war and a rebellion against him and made himself king, he nevertheless loved him. And so he didn't like them. He had ordered for no one to touch. He had ordered Joab and the others not to touch Absalom. Joab said, forget it, I'm not going to do that. Kills him anyway. Amasa is made the general. So he says to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Verse 5, so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. Now that's a warning sign. Of course, it should be a warning sign. I mean, Amasa was general for Absalom and spectacularly fails as a general. His army had lost the battle to an army, David's army, that was in far, far, far smaller than his. And so you may want to ask, well, why did David ever make Amasa the general of his army? Well, we discussed that earlier. He wanted to appease Judah. But this guy, the impression here, it's not that he was betraying David. It's that he was just incompetent. He couldn't mobilize the army in time. Verse 6, and David said to Abishai, so David basically says, look, I can't rely on this guy Amasa. He says to Abishai, another one of his military commanders, the one who wanted to kill Shimei, he said to him, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do to us more harm than Absalom. So he recognizes the great, great danger of allowing this guy Sheba just to go unopposed. And he says, take your Lord's servants, pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. So Joab's men with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, the Cherethites and the Pelethites were like the secret service. They appear to be non-Jews who were Jewish proselytes, because in Samuel, 1 Samuel 30 and Ezekiel 25 to Zephaniah 2, for those of you who are interested, they are listed as being Philistines or related to the Philistines, but they're proselytes. It's one of the beautiful things about David's reign. Again, David being a picture, a type, a foreshadowing of the Messiah, where the nations would be coming to the Messiah on a much smaller scale. That happened during David's reign. And so these Cherethites, Perethites were Jewish, appear to be proselytes, meaning they had converted to Jehovah, the one true God. And he went out after this guy, Sheba. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at its hips. So Amasa, remember, through probably incompetence, had been lagging behind. Well, he catches up to the army, which he's supposed to be the general of, and Joab was there. And so it says in the middle of verse 8 again, Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, are you in health, my brother? And he says that because they're all cousins. Joab was the son of David's sister Zariah. Amasa was the son of David's sister Abigail. They were cousins. So they would have been cousins of Absalom as well. They're all related. And so Joab says to Amasa, are you in health, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Now that would have been custom at the time. What follows would not have been custom, but Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Don't know what to say other than ministry is messy. Again, until Jesus is our ruler and until the government in the millennial kingdom are those who have glorified bodies, things are going to be messy. And this is nothing short of a cold-blooded murder here. It is in no way sanctioned by God or by David, notwithstanding Amasa and the things that that he had done. Now, unquestionably here, he had betrayed David. He had betrayed Israel. He had been responsible for the deaths of many people in Israel, but David had appointed Amasa general. But Joab here, again, just has tremendous disregard for the principle of authority. Even when someone who is above you that is distasteful, You may have a boss above you. You may have a husband above you in authority. You may have someone else, and you really don't like their behavior. You leave it up to God what to do with them. You're supposed to treat them with respect and love and service. Doesn't mean you never confront them for sin and things like that. But Joab constantly overriding the authority of God that had been put over him. We've seen that already more than once. And he kills this guy. And then as soon as he kills him, it says that he took off with Abishai, his brother, and they pursued this man named Sheba, who had fomented the rebellion. So I am going to stop right there, right in the middle of this pursuit of this renegade guy, this son of Belial named Sheba, because we are now out of time.